Welcome to the Scotland series, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast from These Football Times with me, Aidan Williams, as we continue our Scottish series, heading now into the 1980s and two absolute classic World Cups in España 82 and Mexico 86. Tournaments filled with colour, vibrancy, exoticism, magnificent players, great teams. But for Scotland, it would be another frustrating tale of great players and great optimism, but ultimately frustration. They've gone off to Spain singing We Have a Dream. The dream had a familiar ending, unfortunately, in both 82 and 86, even if the manner of Scotland's exits had different frustrations this time around. And we'll get into all of that detail soon. Joining me, as ever, are the two mainstays of this Scotland series. First, with comments as incisive as a David Neary pile driver, it's Mr. Stephen Scragg. How are you doing, Stephen?
Oh, we're doing well, Aidan. Looking forward to this one.
Oh,
this
very
is proper
much so.
Panini album, proper Panini album territory. World this charts, is... the whole lot. Yeah, getting to stay up late to watch some of these games in 86 as well. And just the proper impressionable eye of the storm for me. Well, for you and our guest as well.
These are our World Cups, aren't they? This is the perfect time.
Yes, these are the ones that we gauge every other World Cup by and how they all stink, basically, ever since.
Yes, well, someone, of course, who didn't live through all of that is our other co-host. So he's aiming to leap over pitchside advertising boards like an ecstatic Gordon Strachan, I'm sure. It's our very own Lewis Henderson. How are you doing, Lewis?
Yeah, I'm not bad. I'm really looking forward to the first half of this podcast and less so for the second half. So that'll be a good one, I'm sure. We'll talk about 82 for as long as possible, which I'm sure is not going to be a problem with our guest. So, yeah.
Well, exactly. As you mentioned there, our guest is the expert on the 1982 World Cup. He's already written one book about it and another on the way. He will talk us through Mexico as well, of course, but he knows this era like few others. A familiar voice to everybody on These Football Times, of course, it is Stuart Horsfield. Welcome, Stu.
Thank you very much, Aidan. I'm slightly concerned with the word expert, but that's okay. We'll see how we get on. I'm happy to throw that word out to others. I'm not happy to receive it.
If you've written a highly acclaimed book, Stu, on a certain team in the 1982 World Cup, who will get a mention in this pod, excellent, then I think that classes you as an expert.
Well, okay. I'll go with that, and we'll see how we get on.
Excellent. Okay, so a little bit of scene setting to begin with. We left Scotland after the 1978 tournament. Much hype in Argentina, of course, but then ultimate disappointment that followed. Ali McLeod was then replaced by the legendary Jock Steen, who took over what was still a hugely talented squad at this time. So starting with you then, Stu, talented they may have been, but a lot of initial struggles in the early years before we get to 1982. Jock Steen, I guess, was presumably a hugely popular choice given his previous successes in Scotland. But what about the perception of the initial struggles that he had post-78?
It's a strange one because, and I guess it's, you know, it'll have been covered in 78, but at this time Scotland was... Well, certainly the squads were so tan. There was such an abundance of talented players there. And obviously with, you know, Ali McLeod and the resignation there. And I guess Jock Steen was always, I suppose, not to say he's the equivalent of Brian Clough, but he sort of seemed the big personality, the big choice, the success man. He seemed to be the only choice at the time, the right choice, the perfect choice. And with the talent that was available to him, and this is obviously stuff we'll get into as we discuss the squads at 82 and 86, but certainly when you look at the talent that was available to him on the domestic front, the success that was being had in the major competitions in Europe, it seemed like the perfect sort of the perfect storm. You know, it was ideal time, and I guess, you know, there was potential there for Scotland to do really, really well, which to be fair seems to be the story of Scottish football, or the Scotland national team at the World Cup. There always seems to be a lot of potential, and this seemed like, say, like the ideal time. But you know, you start off with European Championships, qualification there is missed out upon, and sort of once that sort of happens, you're sort of on the back foot, I guess, when a big name takes over at international level with such a talented squad of players, you expect big things straight away. But you know, they don't qualify for the 1980 European Championships, and straight away that kind of puts them on the back foot. You know, they finish second in the group, but it's almost not symptomatic, but it's almost a sign of the things to come. It's that so close and yet so far in, you know, in situations that they should have won success, you know, situations that they should have been comfortable in. Certainly with a manager, such an experienced manager at the helm, certainly the qualifying group for the 1980 European Championship should have been safely navigated, but they don't. And it's really, really difficult to pinpoint why that is, because it can't be players, it can't be the experience of the manager, it can't necessarily be the group that they've been put in, you know, although they're put in a group with Wales, which obviously brings together its own sort of British rivalry, which always makes the qualification a little bit more intense when you are with another British nation in it. But it's sort of so hit and miss. It, you know, it starts with a 3-1 win against Spain, which is great, like, you know, and that's a great result, but it just, you know, they lose at home and it to Wales, and it's just a real struggle for them, and it just seems symptomatic of Scotland as a national team in this era. Potential is massive, talent is there, manager's there, but for whatever reason, the results just don't match up.
Do you think then, Stephen, that there's a bit of a hangover from 1978, given, I guess, the not just what happened on the field, but all the external pressures and the other things surrounding that the sort of drop down was quite dramatic, wasn't it, from a high point? Do you think that stung Scotland a little bit? So their big hopes had obviously been so dashed, and therefore struggling a little bit to find their feet and find their place?
I think it took a little bit of time. They weren't particularly impressive in the qualifiers for 1980, the European Championships. But, you know, yeah, I think Steen's given a bit of a pass for that because the qualifying campaign's already started. Ali McLeod oversees that first qualifier against Austria where they're 3-0 down, I think at half-time, but then come back to lose 3-2. You know, come back to lose. It seems a very bizarre thing to say, but that's what, you know, what they did. It was, you know, kind of shot themselves in the foot and then came back. Within that, you know, Steen's given this remit to get them to the 82 World Cup, which means he kind of has this pass for the 1980 European Championships. The 82 qualifiers, they're actually quite impressive, really. 86, as Stu alludes to, with the games against Wales, is a completely different matter. But 82 is very, very different. They finished top of the group, and 9 goals doesn't sound much, but you know, that was from 8 games. They were still the group's top scorer. It was Northern Ireland that they were in with, and you know, they did pretty well in qualifying. Everything that they did that they could have done, they did prior to the 1982 World Cup. They had a win at Wembley as well against England in 81, in the May of 81. So you know, everything was bubbling along quite nicely for Scotland going into the 1982 World Cup, which was very, very different to what Stu was just explaining about 86. And you know, it was very much a double-sided coin, and that wasn't just down to, you know, the sad loss of Jock Steen, you know, which we'll come to later on. But yeah, 82, they were well positioned in 82. And the thing with 82 is that, you know, Steen, you know, had a huge amount of talent to work with, you know, massive amount of talent. You know, when we come to look at the squad that he takes to Spain, you know, some of those names that don't make the squad are, again, pretty startling, you know, considering, you know, what will come later on. You know, when it comes to major tournaments, it's always one of those things for me is that I think one of the big stories is or one of the glaring things is just who didn't make the plane, you know, who didn't make that 22. You know, there's always kind of like the they always lend that great what if as well, because there's usually some kind of situation in the finals of a tournament where you think, you know, we would have been good for that situation. It's such and such and they weren't there, you know, and Scotland, you know, you've only got 22 places, but yeah, again, there will be some glaring omissions.
Well, as Stephen says there, Lewis, the squad was hugely talented still at this time. So coming into the 82 qualifiers, obviously there's still the likes of Dalgleish and Souness who'd been at the previous World Cup. You've also now got Alan Hansen coming into something of a prime. Now, very much at the elite level of club football with Liverpool in this era, of course. That we can add in others as well, the likes of Steve Archibald, Danny McGrain, many more. So the strength that we've already talked about through the 1970s was showing no sign of disappearing. I mean, there was more coming through. Was this arguably even stronger than the 70s, or is that pushing things a little far?
I would argue, and it might just be because of looking back on football, like a fair amount of my influence comes from talking to yourselves, and obviously this is like the era of football where you were at your most like ingrained and invested in it. So I think this squad is arguably one of, if not probably the greatest batch of Scotland players there had been. And I think, like, if you look at it from example, you mentioned some of the names there, Kenny Dalglish is the best Scottish player there's ever been, in my opinion, through, like, even just out with what he did as a player. If some people will take a statistical, most appearances, most goals for Scotland, and even out with that, the impact he had, we've seen it in this group in 82, all that he does, even though he's kind of coming towards the end of his international career, because he doesn't go to 86, and all that he obviously does for Liverpool. So between him and then obviously mentioned other Liverpool stars like Alan Hansen, Graeme Souness, again, these are three people who are at the core of one of the best sides that England's ever seen. And even out with that, Gordon Strachan was a brilliant player, the likes of John Robertson as well. So I would definitely argue this is one of the best eras of Scottish player there has been. And I mean, with at the helm of that, one of Scotland's, if not football's greatest ever managers, managing them, like the impact that Jock Stein's had on football in Glasgow and Scotland is just absurd. So, I mean, Stu put it really well at the start. For the players that they had and one of the greatest managers in Scottish football ever, and arguably football ever, for this side to not achieve something is a bit of a surprise. But I would also argue, looking back at it, this is probably one of the best performances that Scotland have had at a World Cup. Like, some of the performances we'll talk about were really brilliant, and it was an absolute pleasure to, in terms of the research, go back and look at this side again, because what a side it was.
Well, yes, exactly. Some talent and some iconic games that we'll get onto shortly. But just we mentioned the sort of qualification there, Stu, and they found their form here. They qualified, as you say, top of the group ahead of Northern Ireland, who also went through. I mean, the teams they got through against, there was Sweden, Portugal and Israel. And this is a Portugal who are only 2 years away from hugely impressing in the Euro 84, although obviously at this stage they hadn't qualified for anything for some time. But, you know, they're building into a very talented team. So that's, you know, it's an impressive qualification, very comfortable. So having found their form again, recovered from the little dip, I suppose, what kind of expectations did Scotland go into the 1982 World Cup with? I mean, we talk about some of the great players, the core of the Liverpool team, if you like, that was the best in Europe at the time. You know, obviously getting paired with Brazil once again, a recurring theme through many of these episodes, is a daunting prospect. But expectations must have been relatively high.
Yeah, first of all, this is what happens when you call me an expert, Aidan. Clearly, clearly, in the beginning, not. I went a bit far ahead. However, yeah, I think, like we said, what's clear here is the talent available. And I think it's, when I was looking at it, I think it's 17 out of 22 either had or go on to have major European club final experience. So 17 out of 22 players. You also have players that don't go, that have won European Cups with Nottingham Forest. I mean, Nottingham Forest against Hamburg have four Scottish starters in the side, one on the, John O'Hare on the bench. So, like we said, the talent there is undeniable. And it's the 82 group that they're putting is so similar to 74. You know, you end up with Brazil, who are nigh on guaranteed to be favourites. You then have the Minnows, which is Zaire or New Zealand in 82. And you then have Eastern European opposition, which is the Soviet Union in 82, Yugoslavia in 74. And it almost plays out where, you know, in the sort of same way, Brazil is a free hit, which I guess, you know, we'll come to later on. The Minnows are there for the taking. And it's almost either who can score the most against the Minnows, or it's that crunch game against the Eastern European side that will decide the group. And going into 82, the difference for me going into 82 rather than 74 is, and we've talked about it already, is the big game experience. You know, you mentioned Dalglish, Souness, Hansen, John Robertson, Arch, you know, all the way through this side, John Walk, there are players with big game players, big game mentality. And like we say, with Jock Stein at the helm, everything seems set for Scotland at this World Cup. It's highly likely they're going to finish second. It's very unlikely they would top the group, but it's highly likely that they would, could and should have finished second, like we say, with everything that was in place. You know, once we get into the tournament, and you sort of dissect the games and how they go. But going into 82, certainly for myself as a young lad watching football, it was, I'm not saying it was like another England squad, but I would argue that the Scottish squad, for me, player for player, was better than the England squad that went to the 82 World Cup by quite a way. And I think they had a better manager. I think, like I say, the group they were in, yes, the Soviet Union were a talented side. The Soviet Union, you know, sort of go on to do well in 86. You know, they show glimpses there of what they're capable of. You know, at 88, they get to the European Championship final. But in 82, you know, there is the core of a very, very good side, Soviet Union, very core of a Soviet Union side. But to me, the personnel that is in place for 82 should have been more than enough when it really mattered, when the games really matter, you know, when we get to the games and the Soviet Union game being last, they should have had the big game players to navigate that game. And obviously, you know, we talk about Hansen and Willie Miller and what goes on there. But they should have had enough. The group was there for them to finish second and qualify. The personnel was there. The big game personality was there. The manager was there to navigate it. It's for whatever reason, whether it's a psychological thing, whether there was too much damage has been done in previous tournaments. I don't know. But if you look at it on a piece of paper, player for player, for me, the Scotland side was by far the best side that went from the UK.
Well, let's get into that tournament then. So it began with a comfortable start. They were playing the Minnows from the off, New Zealand. But it got tough quite quickly after that. I mean, Stu, I know that you've spoken to people from New Zealand, and obviously you've studied the Brazil. So for these first two games, obviously the contrast is huge in what they were up against. But, you know, very comfortable start in terms of goal scoring, although maybe a few troubling signs in how many they conceded in that game with what was about to happen to them in the next game. Possibly slightly worrying from that perspective.
Yeah, I think, 5-2 looks a great result in any World Cup, but it's, you know, New Zealand are making their debut in the competition, and I'm not saying it was always going to be about goal difference, but if you go along the lines of Scotland and the Soviet Union very evenly matched, so if that game is a draw, and funnily ends up being a draw, it then goes down to goals scored against the Minnows or goals conceded against Brazil. And unfortunately for Scotland, they concede a few against Brazil. Yes, they score a lot against New Zealand, but the caveat comes that they concede two, and they're coasting at 3-0 at halftime. But then New Zealand come back to get to within 3-2. And you're right, you know, that's the opening game of the tournament, and that probably should have had alarm bells ringing. 3-2 against New Zealand after just over an hour doesn't bode well for what's to come in what essentially was the sort of the easiest game within the group, with Brazil still to come and then the Soviet Union at the end. But they get the result, they score five, and that's great. The Brazil game, you know, and I've read so much about it, interviewed people about it, and the common consensus was that it was a free hit. There was no expectation, not that the professionalism wasn't there to go in and win the game, that's not it, but certainly there was no expectation of getting a result or realistically getting a positive result. 1-0 up with a wonderful goal that should have come straight out of that Brazilian collection of goals. You know, it's a wonderful goal. It's not a topo, as some people seem to think it was. It's not. You know, it's a wonderful goal from David Neri. And for half an hour, they're a match for Brazil. What you can see, though, is that the intensity it takes to hold that Brazil side for half an hour couldn't be withheld throughout 90 minutes, and 1-1 at halftime. But then once Brazil go in front, it's only ever going to end one way. And you would argue damage limitation, but it ends up being 4-1. So you're then on the back foot, because obviously the Soviet Union have only lost 2-1. The Soviet Union with a comfortable win against New Zealand. So that it's that last game where really this Scotland's World Cup fate in 82 is sort of his hands.
Sticking with the Brazil game for a little bit, first of all, Stephen, I mean, there were a couple of changes to the lineup from the New Zealand game into the Brazil one. And Stu's talked there about how well Scotland played, certainly in the first half. I mean, an absolutely fantastic goal from David Neri and matching Brazil to some extent during that time. And obviously it fell away later on. But was there potentially any lingering attitude of sacrificing that game? Maybe not the right word, but, you know, with a view to the decisive game to come against the Soviet Union, was it almost considered just, this is one we have to get through before we get to the decider? And possibly maybe that hampered them in the second half with that attitude in the background. I don't know, might be reading too much into it. What do you think?
No, I think there's something in that. I think Scotland went into that game in the brace position, you know, and you had to, really. I think the Soviet Union were in the better position to play them first. You know, it's always infinitely better to play a big team first. You know, it's always better to play the so-called minnow second or third, because, you know, New Zealand go into that game and they are never going to be more enthused and just completely enraptured by the World Cup than they will be at the first kickoff, that first half, that first match. You know, they'll be fatigued by the second, they'll be jaded by the third, but all the enthusiasm is there. You know, you only have to look at it 8 years earlier when it was Zaire. You know, Zaire's best performance was taking on Scotland because it was the first game. You know, we'll look at it further down the line, but 1990, you know, Scotland absolute cursed to have to play Costa Rica first. You know, there's a common theme running there. You know, when you come to look at 98 and you know, Scotland do get to take the first pop at Brazil, they put up a really good performance and it's, you know, it's a near miss. So yes, 82, I think by the time you go into that Brazil game, it is a case of not necessarily feeling the worst. I think there's a case of go out there, enjoy it, see what you can do. You know, what I love about that David Nerdy goal is, and he catches it beautifully on the outside of his foot. It's the reaction and the celebration. You know, go and have a look at that celebration a couple of times. And there's almost a kind of, there's the initial split second of delight, then there's a bit of disbelief, and then he kind of, it's the body language suggests, oh shit, what have I just done? You know, he knows he's antagonized. This is literally going to the bee's wasp at the end of the garden and hitting it with a cricket bat and then just standing there to see what happens. You know, I've said this before about this game for Scotland. It's an absolute badge of honour to be involved in it. There's no shame in the performance whatsoever. You know, to be on the end of this is, you know, a work of art, and it's, I know there's glory by association to it. You know, I think there's something, you know, absolutely wonderful about this game, and Scotland played a part in it. You know, the goals that they took, that it took Brazil to score to win this game. Yes, one comes from a corner, but you look at the others, there's that epic, you know, free kick that finds the postage stamp. You know, it's the movement, it's that chip is just outrageous. You know, everything about this game is wonderful, and Scotland's part in that is, you know, significant as well. But yes, I do think Scotland were, you know, I don't know, cursed by the run of games that they were given, you know, the set of fixtures they were given. You know, yes, they're the teams that you're going to play against, but the order with which went against them.
And I guess what that leads into is a possible lack of momentum coming into the decisive game, doesn't it? So, Lewis, as in past World Cups, Scotland, they got themselves into a position of a final group match that was effectively a winner-takes-all. Given the goal differences, as the guys have said, that did mean that the draw would take the Soviets through, not Scotland. So Scotland had to win. Presumably, though, as we've said, looking ahead at the World Cup beforehand, they would probably have anticipated it coming down to this decisive match. But yeah, possibly the momentum from the Brazil defeat, whereas the Soviets coming into it on a high, doesn't help. The game itself, I mean, began well, but of course, as we know, it was a step too far. There was the comic collision between Alan Hansen and Willie Miller, we've alluded to earlier, that gifted the Soviets the lead. Do you think, you know, comedy aside, without such incident, do you think they could have gone on and win? Did that sort of knock them back again yet further? You know, they were still playing all right. But then something like that happens and, you know, it's harder to recover from. Do you think that's just that moment in itself was another sort of sliding doors moment where misfortune, a bit of calamity took Scotland's chances away? Or do you think that, you know, it was just more unfortunate across the board that the Soviets were possibly slightly stronger on the day?
No, I do think it is a case of misfortune. And obviously I've got bias in this being Scottish, but Stephen said it really well himself in terms of the you've got to play those teams, but the order of the fixtures does impact it. And just what he was saying about the David Neary goal, Gordon Strachan's actually talked about that since and said, apparently he said to Neary at the time or afterwards, oh shit, we've angered them now. So it's just like, you're going out from that elation of the goal to just the what comes next. And it's absolutely beautiful football. It's one of the most, that set of goals is one of the most amazing things you'll see. And I mean, that's just something that I've got a real appreciation for, that tournament and that Scotland side. And I think quite a lot of that comes down to talking to Stu about it, because Stu could talk about it all day. But yeah, going on to that Soviet Union game, it's, I think the Alan Hansen, Willie Miller sort of collision that we've alluded to and what that means is massive and ultimately a metaphor for Scotland at the World Cup, if you take it at the larger series as a whole. Maybe not this one so much, because I feel like this tournament was more of a, if we sort of look at the last sort of episode, the 74 side rather than the 78 side. I think that this two sets of tournaments work a bit like that, whereas this one's similar to 74 in terms of it didn't feel like failure, it felt like misfortune, like a glorious failure almost, whereas it's just a bit calamitous in terms of what comes next in 78. But Jock Steen, he put it really well himself in terms of, he actually said, we've proved we can compete at this level, if not win. Tonight, I think we've done Scotland proud, both on and off the field. And I think that's all, as a Scotland fan, you want. I don't think Scotland could have done much more in terms of, there's obviously little mistakes that come. There's an Alan Hansen, Willie Miller moment, as we've mentioned, but I don't think you can hope for too much more as a Scotland fan. And some people might say that's very pessimistic of me because we didn't get through the group, but it's, maybe that's just me with experience of never seeing a major tournament as a Scotland fan. But I certainly don't look back on this tournament with disappointment. It's more of a sense of pride to have taken part in such brilliant football. And we'll talk about in the next episode, one of the next episodes, the 96-98 tournament, about a lack of goals. This is something that Scotland certainly didn't have in this tournament, and something that makes for a really nice change. And something, and I think this is why throughout this whole series, I'll probably look back on the 82 team most fondly.
But of course, elimination it was again. So Stu, what was the sort of reaction to this? Was it just huge frustration? Because obviously they come incredibly close, and I guess the way that final game panned out with the moments that we're talking about there with Lewis is, you know, that's got to be more frustrating than having been beaten out of sight, perhaps. Hugely talented generation that again couldn't quite get past the group stage barrier.
I think that's it. I mean, obviously, you know, World Cups are every 4 years, and it's the fact that it takes 4 years to try and rectify either the previous mistake or the previous error, or trying to sort of retribution, whatever you want to call it. It takes 4 years before the opportunity comes again. If it's, you know, if it, in club football, you know, Liverpool miss out on the Champions League against Real Madrid, but then they get to go again the next year and they go on better and win against Tottenham. But in a World Cup situation, you've got to wait 4 years before you even get the opportunity to try and put it right. So with what happens in 78, 82 comes along 4 years later. And, you know, like you said, they have these great opportunities and they meet, as Lewis said, I can't talk about it all day, but I won't, because this is about Scotland. It's not about Brazil. You know, they meet this brilliant Brazilian side. And, you know, Jock Steen is very magnanimous about it. You know, and he sort of, you know, the end of the game, you know, in his quotes, you know, he said, you know, sometimes it's just enough to have shared the stage. And it is, you know, Stephen was right. Sometimes you've got to look and just think, I was a part of it. I was a part of that moment. I was a part of that game. Willie Miller was exactly the same. You know, he said, I wouldn't have changed it. You know, I changed the result, but I wouldn't have changed the experience. I would rather have played in it and lost 4-1 than not played in it and it been closer or drawn. For me, as relatively as a neutral, or certainly not as a Scotland fan, not like Lewis, I think what is very typical of Scotland is that they get it back to 2-2. I think that must be even more frustrating. You know, the go 1-0 up against the Soviet Union, it gets pegged back to 2-1. And I think if it finishes 2-1, you think, okay. But, you know, Souness scores with, I think it's, you know, 3 or 4 minutes to go. And I guess as a Scotland fan, you've got that, just that little bit of hope that, you know, perhaps two quick goals, you know, is there panic in the Soviet Union side? Can we get that third goal? And, I, you know, they say it's the hope that kills you. And I think as a Scotland fan, that must be what it feels like. You know, as Stephen's mentioned, this pattern of even the groups that they're drawn in, but even the order of the games in which they play them, there just seems to be this perpetual case of bad luck where the hope is there and potentially it's there, and then just something comes and snatches it away. And as a Scotland fan, I mean, I've watched England lose countless penalty shootouts in my lifetime, and they're bad enough, but I can't imagine what it must be like as a fan of the Scottish national team to be drawn in these groups, to have these order of games, to come so close, and then to just not get out of that group stage must be heartbreaking. You have my sympathies, Lewis.
Mind you, let's be honest, over Lewis's life, getting to a tournament and failing at the group stage,
well, yeah, being,
you know, preferable perhaps. Final thoughts on 1982, Stephen?
Yeah, I think you've just got to say that Scotland were a match for the Soviet Union. You know, the Soviet Union only beat New Zealand 3-0. It came down to just how, you know, many goals you conceded against Brazil. That's all it came down to. You know, and again, it's, you know, we've used it, I'm sure, a million times over the course of the series, but the phrase of the sliding doors. And, you know, Joe Jordan comes into this game and he scores. You know, he'd scored in the 78 World Cup, he'd scored in the 74 World Cup, he's left on the sidelines until the last game. You know, it's the loss of Dalglish, he only starts the first game. You know, he comes on as a substitute against Brazil, he's not fit enough to play against the Soviet Union. You know, the loss of a player like Archie Gemmell before the tournament. You know, he'd captained Scotland for the first four games of the qualifying campaign. You know, and it was a move to the NASL partway through the 81-82 season that meant he was, you know, out of sight, out of mind, you know, perceived not to be playing football of a high calibre. So, you know, he was omitted from the squad. You know, little subtleties like, you know, the injury to Danny McGrain that took him out of the games. You know, he didn't start either the Brazil or the Soviet Union game. Ray Stewart, who was scoring penalties for fun at West Ham, a really great attacking right back, didn't make the squad. He'd have been the ideal player to deputise for McGrain had he been there. Again, it is all just subtleties. This is, you know, arguably as close as Scotland come. You know, and you know, I will always point back to the fact that, you know, they were the unlucky team that drew the wrong lots as far as, you know, the order of the fixtures.
Moving on from 1982, then Scotland went into a little bit of a lull in the next campaign and struggled again in the European Championship qualifiers, but this time a little more significantly so, I guess, finishing bottom of the group with just one win from six games. But Lewis, do you think this was indicative of a general lowering of standards or a reduction in quality? And obviously some of the principal players that we've talked about, the likes of Dalglish and Souness, for instance, they were aging, I guess, by this stage, or past their prime, at least. In some cases, some of the other top players had retired by this stage. So, yeah, several parts of this question. Is it a lowering of standards that affected them? Was there enough talent coming through to replace them? I guess Steve Nicol is probably one of the best coming through, but maybe not in a position to have quite the impact of the likes of Dalglish. Further forward, and as a result, was the pressure building on Jock Steen as well in this time?
Yeah, I think there is an issue sort of in terms of a lack of quality. Charlie Nicholas, obviously people know Charlie Nicholas now for saying bizarre things on the TV, but at the time he said it himself, he went from fourth choice striker to first choice at the 86 World Cup. Obviously, we kind of talk about what happens, but I think you can look at 86 and say that it was a lack of quality in the squads compared to 82 is the case. And I know there was several players who didn't actually go to the tournament. Obviously, Dalglish, as I mentioned earlier on, wasn't at the tournament. That's a massive loss. That's Scotland's greatest ever player, I would say. Alan Hansen as well didn't go. I believe he was issues with pulling in and out of the squad. And Ferguson eventually gave him the chop. But I think what really did it for 86, the impact and importance that he has in Scottish football, like I mentioned it earlier, he's one of the greatest managers of all time, certainly in Scotland. And it's Alex Ferguson who ends up taking the reins for 86. And he very much considered Jock Steen a mentor, as so many young coaches in Scotland did. And like absolutely horrified by like the passing of him. And it was just so sudden. Like it was that last qualifying match against Wales, I believe. He dies like in one of the medical rooms, I believe. It was He'd stopped taking medicine for a heart condition he had, and there was a buildup of fluid in his lungs, I believe. But I mean, that just shows the man that Jock Stein was. Obviously, I'm not advocating for people putting their literal health before football, but he literally gave his life to football and the Scottish national side. And I mean, if Scotland weren't going to succeed with the greatest ever set of players that, as we've mentioned, and a man that dedicated and that brilliant to the role, whenever are we going to do it? Because what an absolute man Jock Stein was. And I think his loss just overshadows it all. And I mentioned Charlie Nicholas earlier. He himself said that for the only saving grace that came from that tournament was the fact that Ferguson agreed to do it at all, because he's obviously at the time working wonders at Aberdeen and he's about to go to Manchester United. But with him and Walter Smith, again, another brilliant Scottish coach, without them, it just would have been an absolute disaster. And it didn't even go that well, as we'll talk about, but it was absolutely overshadowed by the loss of Jock Stein, because some things are bigger than football, and he's certainly a man who was bigger than football in himself.
Well, yeah, obviously the Jock Stein incident in the final group qualifier was something, you know, a huge impact and rather dramatic. But overall, the qualifying campaign, or a little bit of a repeat of the 78 qualifying campaign with the decisive clashes with Wales, particularly at the end. They were also in with Spain, who were the Euro 84 runners-up, no less. So it was a very tough group, but Scotland, you know, did well. And then going into that final clash with Wales, there was still the possibility of qualifying automatically, although Spain ultimately took that away. Another strong campaign then, Stu, but obviously this dramatic qualifier against Wales that Lewis was mentioning there was, you know, seismic in all sorts of ways, and the impact it must have had on Scotland. And yes, celebrating 1 minute, having fought back into the game, a late penalty from Davy Cooper to take them through into the playoffs, as it was then. You know, coming down from that high onto the incredible low that was unfolding behind the scenes, you know, that must be very hard to overcome.
Yeah, it's very difficult to say, like you say, unless you're there, you know, unless you are there in those changing rooms, in those moments, you know, it's almost impossible to imagine what that's like. And, you know, you're right. As I started off quite wrongly at the beginning with this qualification group and how they negotiated it. But it, again, and you know, Stephen said, obviously, there's been a lot of mention of sliding doors moments. And, you know, and this is, it's such another one. And it's, you know, they start off so well in the group, you know, with comprehensive victories against Iceland and Spain. And then there's sort of the defeat to Wales. And all of a sudden, all these qualification looks nailed on. Then it looks dubious. And certainly 1-0 down against Wales in that final game, it looks like they're not even going to, because they end up making a playoff, and then, you know, they're not going to qualify at all. And then they get a penalty with 10 minutes to go. The sliding doors are in overdrive in this group. And then the next one comes along, which is tragic in all sorts of ways. Not only the loss of life, but it's, you know, and Lewis will be far better placed to talk about the impact that this has, not just on the Scottish national team, but on Scottish football in general. But to lose such a massive character is one thing. To lose a character like Jock Stein in a qualifier that will decide whether or not Scotland go to a World Cup or can still have a chance to go to the World Cup, you know, you can't even begin to comprehend the impact that has. I mean, I remember it as a kid. I remember the paper, you know, the newspaper headlines. There's, you know, there was photographs on, I think it's in the Mirror, I think, on one of the newspapers where, you know, his eyes are closed, he's keeled over, you know, he's being carried by medical staff into the treatment room. And Lewis is right. You know, he eventually passes away in the treatment room at Ninian Park. You know, but it's a different time. And these images are on the back page of the paper the next day. You know, how that must have been for Jock Stein's family, for the players, you know, I've no idea. I can't comprehend how insensitive that is, or how it must have been. But like we said, there were different times. But yeah, how you then recover from that, and Lewis is right again, to have someone like Alex Ferguson and the reputation that Ferguson had built with Aberdeen at that time, it was a godsend that Ferguson had done what he'd done at Aberdeen and was Jock Stein's assistant at that time with the national team anyway. It was such a stroke of good fortune that Ferguson was there to pick up the reins on this. You know, and he does negotiate the playoff, he does negotiate them to the 86 World Cup. But the impact that Jock Stein passing away had on Scottish football, I can't begin to sort of comprehend, because it wasn't someone like Bobby Robson, you know, who is forever associated with the England job and English football and what he did with Ipswich and the national team and so on and so on. You know, and his passing away was rightly mourned, but he wasn't managing at that point. You know, he'd finished with the game at that point. Jock Stein was a young man, relatively young man, when he passed away, but he passed away in the heat of the moment, you know, in this World Cup qualifying campaign, which brings a whole incomprehensible dimension to the situation for the Scottish national team.
And as you say, they then went into playoffs quite soon after with Australia. Playing the European team playing against the Oceania champions, I guess, at that stage. So Alex Ferguson took over. This is still Aberdeen's Alex Ferguson at this point, but like the guys have said, Stephen, he was still very much part of the Scottish setup at this point, even though he hadn't quite become the legendary manager he did. But, you know, this was Ferguson very much in a high point from what he'd achieved at Aberdeen. Was it because he'd been involved in the setup and because he was so respected already, do you think that helped the sort of transition through this troubled time into what obviously was a critical couple of playoffs with Australia? I mean, it could have been quite easy for the whole thing to have been derailed given those events with Jock Stein, but Ferguson, I guess, being part of that camp helped that.
It's the only thing they could have done, you know. But at the same time, on the opposite side of that coin is that Ferguson himself was left in a desperately impossible situation. You know, he's handed these games to take Scotland through to get them to the World Cup finals, and luckily enough, it's Australia. You know, it's not a stern test, and that's, you know, this isn't the Australia of later years that would go on to qualify for tournaments and have, you know, a high number of players playing in top European leagues. You know, this is, you know, a relatively weak Australia. I remember those games, you know, very, very well. I can remember the game at Hampden and Scotland really outclassing them, you know, and the game, I think it was Melbourne, possibly. And I can remember that taking place on a weekday morning, and with the time difference as well. It was on something like Channel 4 as well, which made it really unusual. And I can remember walking to school and it being on. And I can remember walking past the front of a terrace house and the TV was on and the match was on. And me and two mates were stood there watching the game through this fella's window until the fella took the hump and ran to the door to tell us to do one. But yeah, remember these games very, very well. But yeah, I mean, Ferguson was left in a very difficult situation because, you know, this was a squad that, you know, at the end of the day, Stein had been calling the final shots. No matter what Alex Ferguson had been, you know, contributing towards it, Stein had been calling the shots. And you know, the team that Ferguson put together will have been different to the one that Stein will have put together. It will have alienated those who were Steen's players, as some of them dropped away. One of the big oddities was Jim Bett, who was an Aberdeen player. He was Ferguson's player at Aberdeen. You know, he had a prominent role for Steen's Scotland, played in all of the teams that Stein selected for the 1986 World Cup qualifiers. And although he did go to the 86 World Cup, he was left to the periphery. He was shifted to the periphery by his own club manager. You know, little oddities like that that are really, really kind of like out there. You know, yes, it's Alan Hansen. You know, the omnipresent problem of Alan Hansen there. I think he'd only made one appearance in the qualifiers as a substitute, but still, it's Alan Hansen. It's the best centre-back on the face of, certainly in Europe anyway, at that point in time. Certainly the best in the British Isles. You could be, he was comparable to the Baresis. Now, it's odd that when you look at that World Cup, that Franco Baresi didn't go with Italy and Alan Hansen didn't go with Scotland. Two of the best central defenders on the face of the planet there that didn't make it to a World Cup by the choice of their managers. You know, the madness of that would eventually be the fact that, you know, Alex McLeish got injured in Mexico, and Hansen would have been the ideal player for the heat and the tempo of the games. He'd have been the ideal player to have in there. You know, so it's wild conundrums that were left for Ferguson and to select the squad. And again, you're looking at a pool of players there that you can't fit the 26, 27 talented players into a 22-man squad. This is the biggest anomaly ever as far as Scotland are concerned. I think we can point, and Lewis quite rightly said that it's maybe not as strong as the squads that have been before. And this is the point from here on in for Scotland, is that every squad that goes to a major tournament is deemed weaker than what went before. But retrospectively, we look back at it and say, Christ, that was a strong squad. The thing was with this squad is that because Dalglish was initially in the 22 and he pulled out injury, and this is one of the great myths as well, is that because Hansom wasn't picked, Dalglish didn't go, and that wasn't the case. Dalglish picked up an injury and felt that he couldn't do Scotland justice at those finals. Alan Hansen's omission didn't stop Steve Nicol going. It didn't stop Graeme Souness going. Might not be a Liverpool player anymore, but you know, he was a teammate of Hansen's for so long that professionals and people don't turn around and don't go to a World Cup simply because a teammate's not been selected. But within that, because Dalglish was in that initial 22, Steve Archibald wasn't. He missed the cut. Now, this is the man who's just played in the European Cup final for Barcelona wearing the number 10 shirt. He is aesthetically the successor to Diego Maradona at Barcelona. You know, here's Scotland. You know, can you say this is ever likely to happen for any nation, let alone Scotland, to not take Barcelona's number 10 to a World Cup by choice? That's not by injury. That's not by the fact that he'll be suspended for two of the three games he's likely to play. That is by choice. By choice, Alex Ferguson did not take Alan Hansen, and he did not initially pick Steve Archibald. Now, it's absolutely mad. You know, Mo Johnson was another one. You know, he was joint top scorer in qualifying. He didn't get selected. There were a few disciplinary issues, and, you know, he fell foul of that. And this is where Ferguson's disciplinary side, I think a softer, if there is such a thing, a softer version of Alex Ferguson, a more grown-up version of Alex Ferguson, I think, and I think even he admits it. Because if you look at some of his interviews as Aberdeen manager and the abrasiveness of it all, and I think there's one infamous one where there's a cup final that Aberdeen has just won, and he's absolutely turning strips into his players for how they've finished the game, to give the opposition half a chance of taking the game into extra time. This is the Ferguson of that time. He was quite a volatile character. You know, he never truly softened as such, but he became more, I don't know, intelligent in his selections, you know, when to wage war with players, when to kind of, like, you know, lever, you know. And this was the fact with Alan Hansen in this one. This is the fact that Mo Johnson didn't go. You know, this is arguably why Archibald wasn't picked. It's certainly why David Speed didn't go to that World Cup. So yes, you know, Ferguson was left with a very difficult task on his hands, but Ferguson being in charge must have been a very difficult task for the players to handle as well.
Alex Ferguson, what a terrible manager. I don't know whatever happened to him. Well, going into the tournament, I mean, there was, you talk about Archibald missing out and Speedy and Johnson and a few other strikers. They were in a bit of a rut when it comes to goal scoring. Quite a contrast, Lewis, when you were talking earlier about the sheer number of goals that Scotland got in 1982. I mean, going into 86, and obviously what panned out during the tournament is that the strikers couldn't score. Those who did go, I guess it's the likes of Charlie Nicholas, Frank McAvenny, Graham Sharp, fine form for Everton. But, you know, the national team, it was a struggle to score goals. And then, of course, coming into the tournament, they're drawn in the group which possibly coined the phrase group of death. I think it was the Uruguayan manager who coined this for the first time, bringing that into football parlance. So they were with Denmark, West Germany and Uruguay. So this was a very, very tough group. So how were their hopes viewed ahead of this, given the lack of goals and the other issues that we've talked about there that Scotland had coming into it? I guess hopes were not as high this time around.
Yeah, I definitely think expectations have been lowered. And I mean, looking back on sort of the build-up to those tournaments, it seems like both Steen and Ferguson were desperate not to replicate 78 in terms of the just over-ambitious, like, self-indulgent nature of the squad and the management, and just make it, like, assuming that we're at least coming back with a medal, which if it wasn't going to happen with that 82 squad, I'd argue it perhaps never would. But I don't think expectations are quite as high. And I mean, from what I've sort of read back on it from the likes of Gordon Strachan, it was the way the players dealt with it in terms of their days off, there was very little to do in terms of, it was just like a booze-soaked few weeks in Mexico. And I think that's a good metaphor for the actual performance on the field, in terms of just very few people actually turned up and they weren't quite at it. And just in that, we're mentioning, Rob scored to the detail of the games a bit more, but that Uruguay game, the final one that it comes down to, is an absolute disgrace. And I mean, not to be too negative, but that is genuine, like, as close to cheating as you can get without actually cheating. And I'm not looking forward to talking about that one in more depth.
Well, we will be talking about that one in more depth very, very soon. But Stu, why don't you take us into the first games of the tournament before we get to Uruguay? Had to start off with Denmark and then West Germany. That's quite a prospect, wasn't it? But they didn't do, you know, as much as they didn't win, they didn't do too badly overall.
I think, listen to what Stephen said earlier about playing the sort of the big hitters first is when you have your best opportunity. And you only have to look at this group to sort of see how that bears out. You know, so Scotland played Denmark, and you're right, it is the ultimate group of death as far as I'm concerned. You know, the Danish dynamite, who Stephen will be able to talk about as much as I will about the Brazil side. So I'll leave Stephen to talk all about the Denmark game. But you know, they only lose 1-0 to, I say only, they only lose 1-0 to Denmark. And when you look at how the group finishes up, you know, with Denmark 100%, you know, they win all their games. You know, they absolutely destroy Denmark destroy Uruguay in the next game. They comfortably beat West Germany in the final game. So, you know, Scotland's 1-0 bears out what Stephen was saying earlier, that, you know, it's a good result. You know, the best team, as it proves to be in the group, it's a close game, you know, and you know, as the guys have sort of alluded to, it's, I suppose Scotland are very much in transition, not only managerially, but certain, you know, it's the end of that era of European Cup winning players at the heart of your squad. It's different now for Scotland. The expectations are sort of lower. But again, you've got to question Scotland's luck when it comes to major tournaments. You know, West Germany are in the middle of three successive World Cup finals, as it proves to be. You know, the final of 82, they get to the final in 86. They get to the final of 90. You know, if you're going to be drawn against the Danish dynamite, you're going to be drawn against three successive World Cup finalists. And then to top that off, you're going to be drawn against, you know, a South American, well, granted, I want to say, for Lewis's benefit, a Francescoli-inspired Uruguay, but it's really not. But I want to say that. But yeah, it to me, it was a really good opportunity. As much as it was the group of death, it was a good opportunity, because this is again a World Cup where FIFA, in their wisdom, you can finish third in your group and still qualify. So this wasn't, as we know it now, where the top two go through, the bottom two are out, and it's straight into knockout. Yes, you have the knockout stages after the first round group, and not that crazy scenario of the second round group that we see in 82. So at least there's a little bit of sense there, but it's a 24-team tournament still. But FIFA do away with the second round group staging and bring in the last 16. But to bring a last 16, they allow for third place teams to qualify. So really, Scotland only need to be better than the worst team to go through. And yet somehow they contrive to not be, which, and Lewis doesn't want to talk about it, but we are going to have to talk about the Uruguay game at some point. Not only do they not contrive to beat Uruguay, they contrive to not beat 10-man Uruguay from the first minute onwards. It's the sliding door moment, you know, and the guy sort of said it, I can't remember, said earlier, you know, 82 was a brilliant opportunity to qualify into the knockouts, into the next round of a World Cup. Going into the Uruguay game, and after a minute, Scotland were almost in an even better position to qualify for the knockout stages of a World Cup, and yet still couldn't manage it. And off the back of only a 1-0 loss against Denmark and a 2-1 defeat to West Germany, having taken the lead against West Germany, you would have backed, and certainly I did, I think I was 14 at this point, at 14, I backed Scotland to progress against Uruguay after minute one. I absolutely did. And yet somehow, and I'll leave Lewis to explain why, somehow they contrive not to.
Yes, I mean, that was quite a game. We'll let Stephen have his say on Denmark and West Germany first, because I'm sure he's itching to talk about the Danish dynamite, at least from the Scottish perspective, if we can, rather than just eulogising too much about them, Stephen. But
it's hard, Stephen. Trust me, it's really difficult.
I know. I watched you do this for Brazil. Oh, no, you can't. I'll try. I won't mind, but my Denmark shirt is within eyeshot from where I am at the minute. But no. This team was just the best European football inside at that point in time, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, this is a pretty, by West German standards, it's a poor West German campaign, really. Yes, they get to the final. Yes, to come back from 2-0 down to level the final. You know, they could have won it. But, you know, you look at the games that they played, they didn't actually play all that well. They were quite disjointed. And this is what meant Scotland got, you know, I think the best combination of games they could have got for the teams that they were given. You know, the Denmark game, they played Denmark at exactly the right time. This is the first game Denmark have ever played in the finals of a World Cup. You know, they were at the European Championships 2 years earlier. They've come to win a penalty shootout, reaching the final. Everyone knows the less of a surprise now. No one's under any illusions about what you're going to get by playing Denmark. Denmark kind of underestimates Scotland. You know, some of the noises that are made from the Denmark camp in the build to the game is that the game's going to be easy. You know, Scotland don't play, you know, recognisable football. You know, yes, some of these quotes have been, you know, interpreted from the Danish tongue, but, you know, these are the sentiments that go into this game. And Scotland kind of hit the floor running. You know, they have their chances in this game. You know, plenty of chances. They match Denmark, you know, certainly for an hour. You know, and it's not until LKR puts them in front, just short of the hour, that, you know, it kind of shifts. If Scotland nip the first goal, then I think they take something out of this. You know, Richard Gough has chances. You know, Charlie Nicholas was absolutely wonderful in this game. You know, he couldn't have put in a better performance. All he was missing was a goal, but he took a sizeable kick, and I don't think he finished the game, if I remember rightly. But I think Scotland have made their substitutions, and I think Scotland finished the game with 10 men down to this injury that Nicholas had. And yes, you know, this Scotland went into this game. This is very different to 78, where Ali McLeod goes in with no preparation whatsoever as far as the opposition is concerned. You know, Ferguson's done his homework down to a T for this. You know, and he takes on this Denmark side as if he's taking on total football, which in a way he is. And for Scotland to be so competitive in this game, and I think the thing I've come away from this game is that Scotland didn't deserve to lose. I'm not saying they deserve to win it. They certainly didn't deserve to lose it. And it's from here that it gets a little bit more fragmented. Nicholas isn't fully fit for the rest of the tournament, really. He doesn't play against West Germany. He's restricted to the last 20 minutes chasing a goal against Uruguay. You know, and this is the bit where kind of Ferguson loses it somewhat, is that chase for goals, the all elusive goals, is that he doesn't settle on anyone. You know, by the time it's West Germany, he's throwing in Archibald, then Archibald doesn't play against Uruguay. It's, you know, Graham Sharp's thrown in, having not played any of the previous two. So there's no consistency up front. There's no chance of players gelling and forming an understanding. It's too scattergun. But yes, you know, Scotland couldn't have played Denmark at a better time. I think the order of the games was pretty perfect, because it was a West Germany who were feeling their way into the tournament. They'd been lucky in their opening game against Uruguay. It was a late equaliser. They got to take a point in that. People forget about this, that Germany were pretty lucky in this group stage. You know, they trailed against Uruguay, they trailed against Scotland. You know, Scotland had their chances in that game against West Germany as well. Led with a wonderful goal from Strachan. Had further chances. Richard Gough again, he kept on getting up from the back to prove, you know, something of a problem in the penalty area. And it's just a shame, really, is that the way it worked out was that the one game where they definitively needed goals was the one game against Uruguay where they just didn't create chances. That's the thing. They created chances against Denmark. They created chances against West Germany. They didn't create chances against Uruguay. I think that one chance that Steve Nicol has is the closest they come. And I think that's one of the telling things, is that I don't know whether it was the heat of the environment or whatever it was, but they just looked a jaded side, even though they had 89 minutes against 10 men with which to find the one goal that would send them through.
So Uruguay then, Lewis, think of this as therapy, okay? This is good for the soul, trust me. So this couldn't have been more different from the previous Scotland-Uruguay clash that we've talked about on the opening episode of this series, which was a 7-0 defeat in 1954. I know times have changed utterly since then, but, you know, Uruguay kind of sit large in this story from that point onwards, and do again in 1986. Obviously, we talk about the sending off there within the first minute, which very much set the tone for Uruguay. They set their stall out to do whatever it took to hold on from that point on by, I would say fair means or foul, but it was basically by foul means throughout, you know, kicking, spitting, hair pulling, whatever else they needed to do to put Scotland off. But as Stephen says, the chances were just not being created, as much as, you know, they scored a fine goal against West Germany with Strachan, but the strikers weren't firing. And when they really just needed that one goal, the chances just weren't coming. And I guess as pivotal matches go, this was quite far removed from those we've looked at in previous tournaments, the Yugoslavia 74, Holland 78, the Soviets in 82. And yet it's still incredibly memorable because of how it played out.
Yeah, it's one of the worst games of football that I've gone back and watched. And I mean, as a fan of football, I hate to watch it and hate to see things like this. And I'm sure you agree on the whole part of that. But as a Scotland fan, I hate it even more. Just in terms of, it was a war, but it was a one-sided war. Just in terms of, like, you mentioned it. So Uruguay down to 10 men after a minute. And that really sets the scene. It's an absolutely horrific challenge by the Uruguay player. And I mean, Strachan, like, the stretchers were out, but he ultimately played. But you could see it had an effect on him. And I mean, watching the rest of it, it was very, very rough around the edges. And as I said, I think it borders on cheating. Like, it's just a joke. The fact there was one red card is a joke. I mean, so much so that Uruguay were fined after this game for the way they'd acted in this game in the West Germany game. And, like, they were told if they kept at it, they'd be expelled from the tournament. How often does that happen? I mean, that really tells you, like, the extent of this. But, I mean, ultimately, you could say that this is the way they played. Scotland have got to adapt to that, and we just didn't adapt to it in terms of... I think a lot of people did criticise Ferguson for... We kind of mentioned it. It's like the sliding doors moments, the what-ifs. Like, could Graeme Souness have came on? Because, like, he's someone who's a very combative, like, player, unlike some of the players who were on for Scotland. Would it have been different? Scotland didn't really get sucked into that war, but maybe it would have benefited slightly to have someone who was going to push back a bit. But even beyond that, we've talked about the lack of the Liverpool contingent, obviously Souness, but Hansen wasn't there either. And I mean, if you're looking for a goal, is there many people much better than Kenny Dalglish? I'd argue not. And then even with people there, Archibald is on the bench. This is Barcelona's number 10. Like, surely he could have opened the floodgates for Scotland, because we only needed one goal to go through. But I mean, like, nonetheless, like, Scotland were always composed but never really looked like threatening, which is just a bit disappointing. It was just a bit flat. And I mean, whether you could argue that's kind of for the reasons that have preceded it in terms of the absences and the lack of Steen, I'm not sure. But I think more could have been done on this individual game. And I mean, Ferguson afterwards, he said that, like, one of the things that Jock Steen had said to him just before he passed was that they should, like, Scotland should always play with dignity, and he believes they've done that. And I'd say that is something you can take, like, from it. At least we didn't join that war of attrition and start snapping people's ankles like Uruguay did so frequently. And yeah, I've tried not to be too negative about performances in opposition in this series, but this is an anomaly, because it's ridiculous. And I despise this Uruguay side, to be honest, just for this, because it's an absolute disgrace. And, like, I went and looked afterwards, because obviously I'm doing this research and I'm thinking, well, surely it was, like, was this a one-off, or were they, like, just like this? Because obviously I'm looking at it from a Scotland perspective, but they did it against West Germany as well. So it's just, and they did it against Argentina afterwards in the second round match. Not to the same extent, but it's just like, there is no need for that in football. And yeah, it's a disgrace, and I'm glad they didn't have too much success, really, in that period at least.
A disgrace they may have been, but I guess overall, disgrace in this tournament, certainly. But Uruguay, I mean, it fascinates me, always has, as a football nation, for, you know, the achievements they had for such a relatively small size. And this is where I think the similarities, not in this tournament necessarily, but overall between them and Scotland, makes them a fairly good comparison to each other. You know, both are steeped in football history, both pioneers of the game in many ways, both battling against bigger, more domineering neighbours on their doorstep in many facets of life. Similar populations. You know, Uruguay has obviously been hugely successful in the past, featuring this series more than once, as we mentioned. But like with Scotland, Uruguay has had periods where they've been, you know, really successful with a great crop of talent, and others where they've been possibly less so. But I guess in more recent years, Stu, that Uruguay's been able to produce far more than Scotland has, as well as haunting Scotland at various points in this story. Does Uruguay's recent strength over the last, 10 or more years now, I guess you could say, does it show Scotland, or countries of Scotland's size, what can be done with limited resource? I mean, am I making a fair comparison here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great comparison. I think we get engaged in discussions about a whole host of stuff on, you know, most weeks, but one of the things we often come back to is heritage, history, tradition. You know, we talk about it from club side, you know, what makes a big club? And I guess it's the same at international level. Now, part of success at international football is almost what's come before. You know, what are you building on? What what do you have to put your case forward to be a great international side? And Uruguay, you know, at the very beginning of the World Cup, you know, were winners of the very first one. They were Olympic champions. They were back-to-back Olympic champions either side of that World Cup. They don't take part in the next two, but then they win again in 1950 in Brazil in that infamous game in the Maracanã. You know, so they're sort of reigning champions, if you like, for an awful long time, from sort of 30 to 50, 1930 to 1950. They don't actually lose a World Cup tournament. You know, they are world champions because they don't go to the two in Europe. So they have that, and that obviously counts for a lot when you're trying to sort of prove yourself as a nation, prove yourself as a footballing nation. Scotland, you almost become, I guess, like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And Scotland's self-fulfilling prophecy is like, you know, like you say, a very under-resourced nation in terms of population, but an incredibly talented crop of players. And you look at the history of the game. Scottish players dominate English football at club level right throughout the history of the game. They certainly dominate it in that period of success that we've kind of talked about today, late 70s, early 80s. Scottish players have dominated the Liverpool side, the Nottingham Forest side. You know, they permeate right through that. But at international level, it just, for whatever reason, it just doesn't translate. And whether that becomes a psychological thing, I don't know. Uruguay are a complete contrast to that. You know, they dominate early on in the international stage. And so with that comes a reputation that almost goes before them. You know, if you draw Uruguay in your group, you know you're in for a difficult game. But you draw Scotland, and this is no disrespect whatsoever, as this is a series about Scotland. Please don't fire me from the series. But if you draw Scotland in your group, it doesn't feel like it's the same, it's felt with the same trepidation than if you were to draw Uruguay. Quite why that is, it's one of those intangibles. It's very difficult to put a reason on it. But I think your comparison is dead on geographically and population size and potential. But heritage, history, what's gone before, and then what comes from that in terms of the fear factor of drawing one of those sides, Uruguay would be a far more dangerous opponent to draw. And maybe it's because they are prepared to play how they played in 86, but they're also prepared to play the beautiful game if needs to. Whereas I'm not sure, certainly there are many sides in the world, perhaps, who can probably play the very best that football can offer, but also the very worst that football can offer, quite like Uruguay can. And maybe that's it. Maybe Uruguay have that in them that they will do whatever it takes. And I'm not sure there are many international sides that have that.
Okay, then. So, Stephen, what were the prospects going forwards now? And I guess the last remnants of the glorious eras of some of the great players were gone. There's still a fair bit of talent, but did it feel like they're on a downward slope now? We talked, you know, you mentioned earlier about how each successive squad seemed slightly worse than what had gone before, even in retrospect it wasn't. Is that now, does that become a bit quicker after this tournament? And I guess with the 70s... it was only 8 years distant at this point, you know, the hype of 1978. And obviously then that progresses a bit further away in the mists of time. The public optimism of those eras, was that now long gone?
I think the hope still remained because, you know, Scotland fans were still tipping up on mass at major tournaments, you know, demanding or hoping that, you know, the team would be able to go that extra distance that the previous ones hadn't. Yes, you know, how do you replace a Dalglish? How do you replace a Souness? You know, you simply don't. You know, the next set of players that come along just aren't going to be, you know, that caliber. Yet, you know, we've looked at these squads and you know, we'll look at these squads and the good squads further down the line. You know, that's still a decent squad in 1990. That's still, you know, some pretty good players knocking around in 92, in 96, in 98. But, you know, in comparison to 78, 74, 82, 86, they're not. You know, they do get progressively worse. I've looked at the articles for writing and podcast purposes of, you know, pre-tournament articles and match reports. And, you know, you listen to commentaries of old footage and you hear reference of them saying that this is the worst Scottish side to go to a major tournament. And this is where this terminology starts to creep in post-86. Possibly even during 86, you know, it's possibly mooted as well a little bit. You know, retrospectively from three and a half, 4 decades, whatever it is now, it jars somewhat because, like we say, you know, we look at that 86 squad and there's question marks over it in the contemporary era, of that contemporary era, of within that era and the eye of that storm. But we look back at it and look at the ludicrous nature that Barcelona's number 10 isn't selected for the squad initially. He only gets in when Dalglish, you know, drops out injured. So that jars. So you have that historical sense that jars. But yes, moving forward, you know, they are markedly weaker squads each time that Scotland reached the finals of a major tournament. But they're still good squads. And the good squads that came very close to reaching the knockout stages of the tournaments that they played in. But yes, you know, by the time the next tournaments come around, it's a very different landscape. You know, much of the 86 squad does break away. Dalglish still plays a couple of games beyond the 86 World Cup. He comes back to win his, you know, I think record break 100th cap. I seem to remember being a game where Franz Beckenbauer handed him, you know, an award for being the first and I think still only player, the Scottish player to win 100 caps. And Alan Hansen came back into the fold during some of the Euro 88 qualifiers. But, you know, he wasn't around for 1990. And even though he was still playing that season as a Liverpool player, you know, unknowingly he'd played his last game in a Liverpool shirt. The knee injury that had finished his career had really set in. You know, players just mildly like Charlie Nicholas, you know, he dropped off. You know, quite a bit. You know, George Graham joined Arsenal as manager and he lost his way for a few years. He came back, you know, had a bit of an Indian summer eventually. But, you know, you look at these players that all, you know, a lot of them quite tellingly dropped away. Gordon Strachan dropped away after he left Manchester United, would eventually come back again. But, you know, by 1990, he wasn't around. Graeme Souness had, you know, took up management and he never played for Scotland again beyond the 86 World Cup. So, yes, you know, there were still a lot of very good players. And that's the difference. It's that step down in class of a player, if you will. You know, you go from looking at and pointing out the world-class elements of some of these Scotland squads, the Scotland sides. You know, even you go back to that 62 World Cup where they lost out in that playoff match against Czechoslovakia, who would go on to reach the World Cup final. You know, having Dennis Law and we've sadly recently lost him, Ian St. John. You know, the Baxters and the Jimmy Johnstons later on as well. So many great players that didn't even get this close. But then by the time you get into post 86, the Souness's, the Hansons, the Dalglishes are going. Those next players that come along are very good players without being what you would call world-class players. You know, you can be a very good international player without being in that world-class bracket. You could argue the point that, you know, did Scotland really go to the 1990 World Cup with a world-class player? I'd argue they perhaps didn't. You know, have they gone to a major tournament since 1986 with a truly world-class player in their squad? You know, I think you can argue that they didn't. It doesn't mean that you can't put a very good collective together, a coherent side that can do something without world-class players. That's, you know, a completely different matter. You know, Scotland was still very effective going forward and to qualify for major tournaments for another decade or so, yes.
Well, we're just about getting to the end of this episode now, having come through another couple of World Cups. So final question for each of you. Lewis, I'll come to you first. I mean, given everything you've said about Uruguay there, which I'm sure, you know, that got a lot off your chest, was that the most painful of all the World Cup eliminations for Scotland that were discussed or so far and will discuss? I mean, I guess maybe Morocco 98 is another particularly painful one, but where does this one sit given all that surrounded it? You?
I think the difference between Morocco and the Uruguay game is the Morocco one felt self-inflicted. Like we were flat. I think we were flat in both games, but this one felt a bit more like an injustice. That might just be to me. But this one stings even more because if we look at that 98, I think you can sort of tell, okay, maybe not 22 years without qualifying, but you're like, there's a transition coming here. This squad is not what it once was. The management was not what it once was. But it's just when you look back, like we're talking about, this is the demise, like as it starts to seep in. I'd agree with Stephen, there's probably not a world-class player in the squads after this tournament. And I'd argue management was the coaching staff world-class. I don't think we've ever had, it's almost impossible to get a figure like Jock Steen again, really, especially in international management in the modern era. But like, even as I've mentioned, the likes of Alex Ferguson, Walter Smith, two absolutely brilliant coaches who've done so much for Scottish football and football as a whole, more so Ferguson for football as a whole. But it just, this tournament really, for me, is when the demise starts to come, and there's good moments that come after this, but this is, I think you can pinpoint it here. This is when, okay, Scotland stopped being quite the major force in football that they had once been beforehand.
Okay, then, and coming to you, Stu, Scotland here, we talked about two hugely iconic World Cups. You know, as we've mentioned how iconic they are for you, me and Stephen in this era, of course, being our earliest recollections. But, you know, for Scotland, they were iconic tournaments, and they got to play against some of the iconic or teams that have gone down in footballing history. Brazil in 82, obviously, and Denmark in 86, as well as having the USSR and West Germany in those tournaments. Was it overall then bad luck that they ran into these teams who were at such incredible peaks, or was it making it obviously a tough task for them? Or, as we kind of mentioned a little bit earlier, was it good in a way that it means that they got to face some of the very best, they got to take part in some of the most memorable games, or at least memorable campaigns, even if that was campaigns for another team that Scotland just happened to be one of those that was in the way of? Does being a part of that bit of history, is that a good thing, or is that extra annoying?
It's a really good question, Aidan. I think they were incredibly unlucky, and I think that's borne out. You know, and Stephen did again earlier, did a great job of talking about it. Even not only the groups they were in, but even the order that they had to play those games. It's such bad luck. I think if ever I was a professional footballer, I think you would want to qualify at all costs, no matter what, and that would be the important thing. I think as a self-confessed football romantic, to have shared the pitch with Brazil, arguably the Soviet Union, to have shared the pitch with that Denmark side, that's what I would take away. I would take those away, to have played with, or to have played against, shared the pitch with some of the greatest players to have ever played the game, to have played against teams, some of the greatest teams that will live for all time. I think that I would rather be a part of that than to have got through to the last 16, but not have anything memorable, any memorable moments, not to have played against such iconic sides. I think as a football romantic, Lewis won't agree with me, but I'm quite happy with Scotland's lot in life in 82 and 86. I think the one thing that I wish out of all of this would be to have seen Scotland play against Diego Maradona and Argentina in 86, and the Uruguay not to have played, but to have watched Scotland play against them, and then, you know, had Scotland have achieved the incredible and then gone on to play England in a World Cup quarterfinal, or for Maradona to have played against Scotland and then to have played against England. I think that's probably the one unfulfilled moment that comes from all of this. Yeah, as a professional, yeah, they were unlucky. As a romantic, no, it was perfect for me.
And we are nothing if not hopeless football romantics.
Exactly.
Here,
so, yeah, sorry, Lewis.
Perfect for us. And final one for you then, Stephen. Simple question. Would Scotland's history have been different from this point on if they'd managed to persuade Alex Ferguson to stay on as manager instead of going to Manchester United?
No, I don't think it would have been. For me, I don't think Scotland did much wrong with the choices they made beyond the 1986 World Cup. You know, the world was Ferguson's oyster by 86. You know, he'd done everything he possibly could for Aberdeen, bar win the European Cup. You know, he'd won everything he could do domestically. He'd broken the hegemony of Celtic and Rangers. He'd, you know, held his own with Jim McLean's Dundee United. He conquered the Cup Winners' Cup. Got to the semi. They got to the semi-finals. Hopeless. You know, this wasn't a flash in the pan. You know, all of these put Ferguson on the map. When you're looking at the history of the Scotland job, as Lewis said, you know, Jock Stein was something of an anomaly. You know, the SFA didn't pay big wages to the Scottish manager. You know, if they did have the big personality in the job, it tended to be on a part-time basis, as it was with Jock Stein in the mid-1960s, or, you know, a manager that was, you know, at a loose end because he'd been sacked elsewhere, as was the case with Tommy Docherty at the beginning of the 1970s. So, you know, beyond that, you know, the SFA tended to play the percentages. You know, Ali McLeod from Aberdeen, was one of those. It was, but it wasn't. He'd made his name at Ayr United. He would go back. No, he left the Scotland job to go to Ayr United. Willie Ormond, went into club management. He snapped the opportunity up midway through the qualifying campaign for 78. The SFA and the relationship with the managers has always been a little bit fragmented. Even today, it's not. You always get this feeling like they don't see it as a full-time job. And yes, it's not really a full-time job as such. It's a part-time job as far as games on the pitch are concerned and having players on the training pitch. But it's a full-time job as in, keeping an eye on who's in form. They don't switch off, for the 6 months where there's no game. They're constantly looking out for the player in form. They'll cast their eye through all the different age groups. It's a full-time job. And I always get the feeling with the SFA is they don't rate it as being a full-time job. It's almost like a bit of an afterthought. Even now, there's a little bit of the draconian 1950s at play. And I think if Ferguson in 86, he had bigger horizons. Whether if it had not been Manchester United, he'd already been offered the Tottenham job. If it had not been Tottenham and Manchester United, there'd have been another big English club that had come knocking for him, and maybe even one overseas. There was once talk of Ajax making contact with him. There'll be Ferguson experts out there who will know all of the offers that he had on the table. But he could have gone anywhere. He was one of the most in demand football managers on the face of the planet at that point in time because of what he'd done with Aberdeen. And I think he got a lot of respect for stepping in and carrying Scotland after the sad loss of Jock Stein, which was utterly shocking. We all covered this earlier on, but I watched that game that night and still have vivid memories of it. I've not watched the footage. I don't even know if it's available. I've seen the goals and stuff like that. It's another wild anomaly that it's Davy Cooper that gets the goal. The tragic Davy Cooper, is another one. So going back to Ferguson, I don't think he could have done any better really than Andy Roxburgh did. You look at the players that, and that, oh, that sounds a bit mad, but I think Roxburgh did as good as he could. He was prepared. He learnt a lot from Ferguson, I think. I think a lot of Ferguson's approach to football was carried by the men that did the job.
Okay, then, well, we'll wrap things up there for this time. So we'll be moving on to the 1990s soon. But thanks, fellas, for all your contributions today. Lewis, thank you very much. If we've learned nothing else from this, is that you're not a big fan of Uruguay.
Yeah, you're not wrong there. And I mean, I'm looking forward to the demise that we've talked about. But at least we've got some European championships to talk about coming up. So silver linings and all that.
Excellent. Cheers for today. And thank you also, Stephen.
Oh, I had an absolute ball, and Lewis is right there, saying that they're going to go into demise. They're going to start qualifying for European Championships, which is a hell of a demise, really.
Exactly. And thank you very much for being our expert today, Stu. You got it. Perfect fit for these tournaments. So thanks for all that. You really should write a book about 1982, Stu.
I'll have a think about it. It seems like there's quite a lot to write about. I'll give it a go.
Excellent. So we're leaving the 1980s behind for our next episode and heading into the Andy Roxburgh era, as the guys have mentioned. So that's be with the last of Scotland's run of five successive World Cups in 1990, as well as a very first European Championships in 1992. So please join us next time for that one. But for now, thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Cheers and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.